Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them.
Disrespect welcomes Simon Black of the City Institute of York University to discuss the situation in Greece and how it compares with what Madeleine Muir has called the burgeoning situation in Ontario. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Okay, Simon, I'm looking forward to this. What is actually happening in Greece?
Well, I think in order to understand what's happening in Greece and in order to understand the response to it and the mass mobilizations we saw the past few weeks where Greek workers took to the streets and basically refused to go along with the government-imposed austerity measures that the EU and the Greek government had jointly came up with, we need to understand the context for this, the larger historical context, and this includes Ontario as well. And the historical context has to do with the economic and social policies that governments have enacted across the industrialized world and in the global south since the 1970s, which we know as neoliberalism. And this has included free trade, the deregulation of labor markets, making it easier to hire and fire workers.
So what we're seeing has been building for 35 years.
It has. And okay. this latest economic crisis is very much a culmination of this.
All right.
Neoliberalism also meant the free movement of capital. You know, employers were able to move factories wherever they wanted to. Investors could take their money and invest it wherever they wanted. Attacks on trade unions, cutbacks to social programs, basically an abandonment of full employment policy by governments, privatization of everything from healthcare to water, and an end to the universality of social programs where everybody could benefit from a social program to a more kind of targeting of social investment. But
so it's a big change from what the boomers knew in the 60s.
It is. It's a complete change. It's a very much a change from what we knew as the welfare state in the post-war era, which was built up as a response to the experiences of the Great Depression and World War II,
right,
and the mass mobilization of working people across the industrialized world, including in Canada, where labor movements were strong, and you also had the growth of communist parties and the Russian Revolution, which showed working people that there was a potential alternative, and this often scared elites into providing a better standard of living than what working people would otherwise have access to.
Okay.
But an interesting quote I have from a British academic, Stuart Hall, was, although neoliberalism was about free markets, he said that markets were to be free, but the people were to be disciplined. So alongside all this free trade and, you know, free movement of capital, we've also seen a lot of penal policies. We've seen the growth of the prison industry, not so much in Canada, but although it has grown, but the United States as well.
Well, in Canada, it's still growing, unfortunately.
It is, and this is very much this growing response to poverty that comes from all the cutbacks to social programs in North America and in Canada has meant that the state, the government, has to deal with the outgrowth of the contradictions of neoliberalism, that is, you know, growing poverty, growing inequality, the expansion of precarious employment, people not having access to a decent standard of living through work. So the growth of penal policies, the disciplining of the people, has come through the expansion of programs like workfare and also community policing,
We have police all over downtown Hamilton trying to present that handing out tickets to people who can't even afford their daily bread is a superior form of community policing to the kind that would have stopped the death of a beloved shopkeeper's wife here 2 weeks ago on a main street in a store facing the main street of Hamilton, King Street. And the contrast is just, it's just very disheartening.
Right. So we see this. I mean, we see it in Hamilton, we see it in Toronto and across the country. And I think one of the ways we need to understand what's happening in Greece and also with the latest, the economic crisis, which precipitated what happened in Greece, you know, with the meltdown of financial markets in 2008, was that working people were used to a rising standard of living. You know, from 1945 to the mid-1970s, there was a growth in incomes, there was redistribution through the welfare state. Working people had more and more a share of profits that were being created in the economy, a greater share of the social wealth, we could say. And when that stopped in the 1970s, when wages were basically stagnant as the labor movement lost power, as trade unions were under attack, working people kept their standard of living through accumulating more and more debt. There's record levels of household debt in North America and across the industrialized world. And that is one of the reasons that we saw the crisis in the U.S. housing markets, the way it unraveled. And also there's rising debt levels, student debt levels. So working people have kept the standard of living by taking on more and more debt. Now neoliberalism wasn't just something that happened in the industrialized world. In the third world, or what we know as the global south, neoliberalism came in the form of structural adjustment programs, which were implemented by the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and the World Bank. And this, if we want to look at the riots and the unrest we saw in Greece, it's interesting to look back in the mid-1990s, where we saw riots and unrest across the global south that continue to this day in response to these structural adjustment programs, which were very much about cutting back the minimal welfare provisions that states in the global south had, cutting back agricultural subsidies, privatizing state industry, including water, raising prices on food, water, and cooking gas.
This is what Greece is facing now.
This is exactly what Greece was facing, and it's at the hands of the same people.
But this is the first time it's been done to Europeans.
Well, this is what's new is that we see the type of measures being enforced upon the global south in the 80s and the 90s in response to their debt crisis.
Yeah.
Is now being opposed on countries in the industrialized world, and Greece is a member of the European Union. So the type of discipline that was imposed upon poor and working people in the global south is now being imposed upon the people of Greece. And the IMF has been very much involved, along with the European Union, in putting together this package for Greece in order to bail the Greek government out.
Much as the way they asked of Argentina, but I think Argentina rejected it, didn't they?
In 2001. And Argentina was endured a financial meltdown. And,
yeah. But not at the hands of the IMF.
Well, they rejected. They rejected IMF. Eventually, they had to take on some loans, but it was very much different under different circumstances. But this latest crisis, you know, what they're calling the Great Recession of 2008.
Yeah.
This has been shown throughout from the 1970s. We've gone through the Latin American debt crisis. We've had the Asian financial crisis. We've had the meltdown in Argentina. We've had the new economy and dot-com bubble.
So they're in good shape now, and it's us who faces the constraints.
Right.
Yeah.
But it shows that the system that's currently constructed is crisis-prone.
Yeah.
So as governments have had to stimulate the economy in response to the Great Recession, and you know, there's been massive government bailouts to the financial sector in the United States, and in Canada, the banking sector has been, you know, somewhat more sheltered from it. But the government has had to embark on a stimulus package, which has meant an increase in spending, which has been good. It's addressed a lot of infrastructural deficits in Canada, although probably not enough. What we see is now governments have these debts and deficits, and rather than saying, this crisis-prone system of neoliberalism that we've had for the past 30 years needs to be fixed and we need to abandon it, governments are responding, as they have been for the past 30 years, to debt and deficits. And that's to cut back supports, income supports, to poor and working people. You know, it's just one instance. And this is what the comments from Madame Millière really gets at.
Okay. But she's mistaken. I can't think of a more appropriate word. She's mistaken, or she's either that, or she sees the hard times that they want to bring in, and she's making excuses for them ahead of time when she compares Canada to Greece.
I mean, right.
Canada's one of the heroes of the economic crash.
She's mistaken, really, in two respects. She's attributing Greece's problems to saying that Greek workers and poor people in Greece have been greedy.
Right.
And that they have too great a standard of living,
mm-hmm.
and that their income support programs and their welfare state has meant that the Greek government has been overly generous to the Greek people.
Yeah.
And so that attributes the problems in Greece to not the financial markets or the banking system,
or the causes of the Greek recession. Or the civil service, for that
right.
matter.
Or the very rich Greek elites who have avoided paying income taxes.
Yeah.
For so long, and it attributes the Greek crisis to, you know, the most vulnerable, and the poor and the hardworking people
yeah.
of Greece.
Yeah.
So she's mistaken in that respect, but it's a political tool that is very it's rhetoric that can be very convincing because people might not understand, you know, the way the Greek crisis has been presented in the media. It seems overly complex.
No, and people have just lost a third of their investment portfolios are frightened.
Right. And to make a sort of comment like that, like, oh, if poor people in Ontario continue to demand the kinds of things that the rich poor, which is what she makes it sound like, you know, the rich poor and working class of Greece, it's
mm-hmm.
almost contradictory, then Ontario is going to be in the same type of crisis situation as Greece is. And this is just absurd. But it's really not surprising coming from a government that committed to a poverty reduction strategy and in the end has done very little to address the needs of the poor.
Yeah, that's true. I think this summer they're coming up with guidelines for a study of poverty. And I doubt very much that it'll be in it anywhere what the stop did, that people have to live on a food basket for a week or a month.
Right, and that was a great project that the stop undertook, and the government seems to respond to poverty thus far, and its poverty reduction strategy has so far consisted of studying things, studying poverty to death, and reviewing poverty policies. They've just undertaken a review of social assistance, but the cutback to the special diet program, which happened in the last budget, is particularly important, and it's important for this reason, is that poor Ontarians, you know, along with groups like the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty,
yeah.
other anti-poverty groups,
yeah.
really mobilized to get that special diet more widely accessible to a great number of people on social assistance
yes,
and disability.
They did. Yeah.
And what you saw was a budget for the special diet going from about $6 million in 2002 to about $200 million in 2010.
All right.
So that's money that poor people have won through their own ingenuity, through
yeah.
mobilization, through being active, through saying to government elites that, you know, we are going to take what's deserved and what's our social rights.
Well, you can't hide our benefits. We're coming forward to claim them.
Right. And we're coming forward to claim them, exactly. So the government has looked at that. I mean, it's one thing to cut back on something that the government has given in the first place, but it's another thing to cut something that poor people themselves have mobilized and have won.
Mm-hmm.
And that sets a very dangerous precedent, I think, in the eyes of the Liberal government, is that if poor people can mobilize and win this sort of money and win these sort of gains,
yeah.
then what does that tell? What does that tell the labor movement, which has been on the back foot for years?
That's true.
What does that tell women's groups?
Yeah.
What does that tell homeless advocates? What does that tell disability advocates?
I never saw it that way.
It tells them that if they mobilize and that if they can develop a social movement with the type of strength that the anti-poverty movement has been gaining in Ontario, then the government's going to have to give up the dough.
Yeah.
And they don't want to do that.
No, they don't. I guess because it's theirs at the moment. They don't want it to become anybody else's.
Right. Well, it's theirs in the sense that they tax us for it.
Right.
And
exactly.
Right. Yeah. And they have a certain idea of what they want to do with it in terms of paying off the deficits that have been incurred as a result of the financial crisis, which is, which was not caused by poor and working people. It was caused by the rulers of the world in the banking and financial system.
Okay.
Now we'll take a short break. Before we get back with Simon Black, listen to Omar Dykes' "Dirty People."
Better watch your step. Be careful what you do. The word's going round about some bad hoodoo. Stop your signifying. Be careful what you say. When you least expect it, they will haul your things away. I'm talking about dirty, dirty people. Behind on the water bill. Don't back me in no corner. You might get killed. Don't mess with my money. Don't mess with my soul. You mess with my monkey and your head is gonna roll. I'm talking about dirty, dirty people. Thief, but I ain't gonna let them get me. I'm just too mean to cry. I guess they're gonna hold me now until the day I die. I'm talking about dirty, dirty people.
Pretty sizable turnouts. There was a day of action against the cut to the special diet that was called for by the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, OCAP, just I guess it was a couple of weeks ago now. And we saw turnouts in
May 20th.
Yeah, May 20th. We saw turnouts in Windsor, in places like North Bay, where we wouldn't normally see...
Mike Harris' hometown, yeah.
Yeah, we wouldn't normally see kind of active... mobilizations from anti-poverty groups, and Mississauga and Brampton, there was a protest as well. So,
in overview then, this model of what has happened in Greece, I thought it was like bloated civil service, all kinds of indexed benefits, a government unwilling to go against what's popular with the civil service as their voters. But no, you're saying it's a consequence of this neoliberal priority for what to do with the money that's taxed from society.
Right.
And in that sense, it is very similar to what could happen in Canada. However, our situation, our starting point is different, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is different.
Well, so this is a scare tactic. We're in no way facing a situation like Greece. We have money in the bank.
It is a scare tactic. Although when we look at the forces, the forces of big business and of capital, which are pushing this austerity measures on Greece through the IMF and the EU,
yeah.
We can remember back to the Ray government and the NDP government in Ontario, when they tried to introduce a public auto insurance, and also to address with that time we were in a recession as well, and there was expansion of social assistance, and the NDP government eventually turned the corner and cut back on social spending. But one of the reasons they cited they did that was because bond rating agencies were threatening the credit worthiness of Ontario.
Okay.
One of the ways that governments raise money is by issuing bonds.
Right.
And the amount of interest that they'll pay on these bonds is very much linked to
their credit rating.
And there's only about 3 or 4 credit rating agencies in the world that have a lot of pull. One is Standard & Poor's. There's another one called Fitch. Another one called Moody's.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at what's happened in Greece, is that bond rating agencies had a look at what the Greek financial situation was and said that there was no way that Greece was going to be able to pay back the debts that they had incurred and to address the deficit that they had, which was about 10-12% of their gross domestic product.
Okay.
And so
that's about Ontario's, isn't it?
It is, and that's another comparison we could draw. That it's the same as the UK and the US as well, but Greece has been targeted as being the example.
Yeah, but Greece had to draw on the whole European Union for support if they had trouble paying it back. Ontario's part of a federation in which drawing on the other members of the federation in better financial shape is enshrined in the Constitution, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. So Ontario's in no way in the same situation as Greece, even if the numbers look similar.
But what we see is that the same forces, the credit rating agencies and the financial speculators who have driven up the interest rates on Greek government bonds, were also, behind the attack on the NDP government spending in Ontario.
All right.
So the main point is that the power of financial capital of banks and of financial speculators and investors is so much so that even when democratically elected governments like the Greek Socialist government and like the NDP government in Ontario want to introduce measures that will shore up the standard of living of the majority of the population through democratic means, is that democracy under capitalism means that some people, we all have the vote, but some people have more power than others, right?
Right.
So the bond rating agencies and
not subject to vote, right?
Have been able to change the agenda of the Greek government effectively.
Okay.
Even though the people have supported the measures and elected the Greek government.
And effectively, this is what Madeleine Muir is threatening may happen here, and I don't imagine even the people in government like it.
No.
I mean, to say that, you can't set the agenda anymore because you're spending too much money and the guys with the money are going to tell you what to do is what she's saying.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how much they accept it as a fact of, as a fact of governing, as a fact of life for governments, that democratically elected governments have to listen first to those that are bankrolling their debt as opposed to those who elected them.
Yeah,
and it says something about the power
of money,
of the power of money within liberal democracies like we have in Canada.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised though that a government like a pimple or a blackhead, that a government just pops someone from inside who relies on the democratically elected system to join her colleagues comes along and says, "Well, I no longer answer to that system, and you may no longer be able to answer to that system. You will have to answer to another system." And the first reaction of her colleagues would be fear, and the second would be, "She's got to go."
Right.
You know.
Right.
So we've yet to see the outcome of this kind of bravado from a member of Treasury, someone so conflicted that she's a member of Treasury Board and she's the Minister of Community and Social Services. So obviously, if she wants to play her role in balancing the budget, the only tool she has readily at hand is the benefits supplied to those who can't provide those benefits for themselves.
Right.
And the answer for her is obviously to take them away.
And this is not unusual for someone to have these dual roles in government.
Really?
What we've seen under neoliberalism is that the what we may call the right hand of the state, and that is, you know, the Treasury, the finance departments,
yeah,
have had more control over social policy than what we traditionally thought of as the left hand of the state. Those,
that's true,
those agencies and ministries which are in control of providing services and social programs and thinking through social policy.
So in the eyes of such a liberal government, the Minister of Community and Social Services, no matter how much her budget is, which may be large and may even be growing in these times, and no matter how many staff she commands, and in fact, no matter how many people's lives she affects, it's a trivial role compared with something like a seat on Treasury Board.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow. So maybe that needs to change.
I think the Minister of Finance does have much more power,
yeah,
in a government than a Minister of Community and Social Services.
Unless, as you say, the people her ministry affects the closest, and their families and their caregivers and their supporters, medical and otherwise, mobilize and make their vote felt.
Right, and I think this is the lessons from Greece are,
yeah,
that only sustained mobilization,
yeah,
of people will be able to push back the sort of austerity measures that governments will want to introduce to address the deficits they've incurred as a result of the Great Recession.
Okay,
and whether we're going to see that sort of sustained mobilization in Ontario, it's too early to tell, partly because the government has yet to, I mean, the last budget was bad, but the government's really yet to embark on kind of serious cuts, apart from what's been happening in the public sector and its commitments there, that will affect increasing numbers of people. But I think with the next budget, we'll see where they go, and we'll see how...
That's right. We have one more, don't we?
Respond. Yeah, we'll see how the labor movement responds, and we'll see how the anti-poverty movement responds, and other popular groups.
Yeah. Well, I think you've delineated an interesting task ahead for the people who want to claim their entitlement in society as the people who create society. And I wonder if you have anything else to add to that. It was very succinct and valuable.
No, I guess the only thing I have to add is that in this time we have to look at throughout the history of capitalist economies and of democracies, it really is only when people engage in mass mobilization that they are able to win the sort of gains that we recognize as being part of the standard of living that we all value today, whether it be social supports, whether it be a public health care system, whether it be a trade union rights,
right,
whether it be reproductive rights, that this is only the result of social struggle. Very rarely are things handed down from on high.
So we're not the bystanders that they're trying to make us out to be. In fact, we're the engine that drives the shape of society in the future to come.
I think that's a great way of summing it up.
Okay. I appreciate your time with us today, Simon, and appreciate the opportunity to give you a role in this big change that seems to be looming.
Thanks for having me on, Jeff.
Thanks.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news.
Remember, these aren't the articles we read to you. These are abridgments or condensations of the articles, which you'll find in the papers whose names we broadcast during the show. First up, half of Ontario to feel HST sting, from the Globe and Mail. Karen Hallett in Toronto. One half of the 5.3 million households in Ontario will feel the brunt of the province's looming harmonized sales tax, including middle-income earners who were supposed to be unaffected by the new levy, the government's own study shows. The study is the most exhaustive attempt to date to measure how the sweeping tax changes will affect households at various income levels. Premier Dalton McGuinty is under attack by opposition members over the harmonized tax, but Mr. McGuinty's having a much easier time than Premier Gordon Campbell in British Columbia, where former Premier Bill Vanderzom has helped ignite a grassroots rebellion against the tax. Harmonization comes into effect on both provinces on July the 1st. Finance Ministry officials in Ontario prepared the study as part of the government's public relations campaign to sell the controversial tax to the public. The McGuinty government is selling the harmonized tax as something that will make Ontario more competitive and generate new jobs. Harmonization will shift the tax burden from businesses to consumers who will pay more on goods and services, ranging from haircuts to fitness club memberships. While officials have acknowledged there will be some short-term pain for consumers, they've argued that this is the price to pay for building a more prosperous economy. We've told people this isn't easy, but on balance, if this is something we can do to actually make sure we have full employment in this province overall, that's what's going to support schools and hospitals and public services, Revenue Minister John Wilkinson said in an interview. Globe and Mail, Karen Hallett. How the Whitefish Band Turned the Tide on HST. 2,500 emails to Flaherty and six-minute talk empowered natives in standoff over tax. Chief Franklin Paiwam Sai of the Whitefish River First Nation in Ontario is finishing plans to blockade the highway leading to Manitoulin Island over the long weekend in May when the phone rang. It was Federal Finance Minister Jim Flaherty. "You're the hot topic of the day," said Flaherty, adding that this was his first call he had made since returning from a trip to India. Their conversation on the afternoon of May 20th lasted only 6 minutes, but it marked the turning point in a long-running standoff between Native leaders and the federal Ontario governments over the province's new harmonized sales tax. The accord was reached after marathon talks among Native and government officials against a backdrop of threatened blockades during this week's G8 and G20 summits, according to interviews with officials at the table. The tax break has stirred up fresh controversy, prompting Native leaders in British Columbia and Atlantic Canada to demand similar exemptions. Their case is a harder one to argue, though, because unlike Ontario's First Nations, they have never obtained an exemption on their provincial sales tax. Even in Ontario, the agreement's not calmed the waters completely. Residents of Batchewana First Nation, a community of 2,400 near Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, blockaded nearby railway tracks on Monday morning with a 5.5-meter teepee. Chief Dean Sayers says the exemption deal does not sit well with his people because it does not come into effect until 2 months after the HST is introduced July 1st. The blockade will remain in place definitely, Chief Sayers said, forcing Huron Central Railway to reschedule the two daily cargo trains that use the track. He said the federal government has failed to honor many agreements with Aboriginals. It just seems coincidental that during the G8 and G20, they managed to have most First Nations actions put over until everybody is gone. It was Mr. Flaherty's promise to Chief Paiwam Sai in the May 20th phone call to meet with Native leaders that led to the talks. Chief Angus Toulouse assured a bulletin saying Native leaders were prepared to back up their demand for an exemption, quote, with action, quote. At that point, Mr. Manitowabi said the federal and provincial officials agreed to meet around the clock over the June 12th to 13th weekend. By June 17th, they had a deal. The leader of Whitefish First Nation, known as Chief Shining Turtle, said his tiny community of 1,100 residents can take great pride for ending the stonewalling by the federal government. Members of his community had inundated Mr. Flaherty's office with more than 2,500 emails, but it was the threat of the blockade that was to begin the following morning along a stretch of Highway 6 at Birch Island that finally got his attention, say those involved in the talks. The chief called off the blockade after speaking to Mr. Flaherty. Flaherty could have called any one of the bands in Ontario, but he called the Ojibways of Whitefish River, he said. We'll always be remembered for that. Globe and Mail, Carly Weeks. Thousands of children facing unacceptable wait times for surgery. In 2009, more than 17,000 children were not treated within time frames deemed acceptable by physicians, an annual report released by the Wait Time Alliance shows. The report exposes new depths to Canada's chronic care deficiencies in managing wait times for common health procedures. The Wait Time Alliance is made up of more than a dozen of Canada's leading associations of physicians, including the Canadian Medical Association, Canadian Cardiovascular Society, and Canadian Association of Pediatric Surgeons. Its mandate is to hold federal and provincial governments accountable to a $5.5 billion promise to minimize lengthy wait times for five major areas of care identified by health ministers in 2004. The scope of problems outlined in the new report comes after several regions of Canada missed the March 31st deadline to establish guaranteed maximum wait times for at least one area of care. Alberta and the three territories either failed to implement a guarantee or didn't release enough information to indicate one was in place. Guarantees set by other provinces were often weak and in some cases set excessively long waiting periods as guaranteed times for treatment, according to the Wait Time Alliance. This year marks the first time the Alliance has included a comprehensive evaluation of wait times for pediatric procedures. Although 73% of children received surgery in the benchmark established by Canadian Pediatric Surgical Wait Times Project, which was designed to measure wait times for children, more than 17,000 children had to wait for excessive lengths of time for treatment. The biggest problems occurred in dentistry, plastic surgery, and ophthalmology. Many children with serious dental issues must be treated in hospital, and those with cancer or other illnesses have to undergo emergency dental treatment, said James Wright, a professor of surgery at the University of Toronto and head of the Canadian Pediatric Surgical Wait Times Project. A number of children are also born with a cleft lip and/or palate that requires corrective plastic surgery. In addition, it's also very common for children to require surgery for wandering eye or other issues with sight. The majority of children must be treated for those problems in a timely way to minimize the chance of lifelong complications. For instance, cleft lip and/or palate surgery needs to be performed at the correct time to ensure normal brain and speech development. Serious problems can also occur if a child isn't treated for a wandering eye. We know that unless it is dealt with in an appropriate time frame, that can permanently affect their ability to see, Dr. Wright said. José Bellemare, press secretary to Federal Health Minister Leona Aglukkaq, said in an email, the report reflects important progress made by the government, but many problems persist and there doesn't seem to be enough political will to fix them once and for all, said Lauren Bellin, co-chair of the Wait Time Alliance. In the Wait Times Marathon, we're still on the first mile, Dr. Bellin said. Globe and Mail, Adrian Morrill. Family tries to link drug with teen suicide. Sarah Carlin's family says Paxil drove her to take her life. Drug company says she was depressed beforehand. To Sarah Carlin's family, a prescription drug meant to cure her anxiety triggered a deep depression that led her to hang herself. To the company that makes the drug, the Oakville teen was already troubled and her medication was working. These were the competing narratives at the close of a coroner's inquest into Ms. Carlin's death. Ms. Carlin, who had just finished her first year at University of Western Ontario, hanged herself with an electrical cable in the basement of the family home in May 2007. A lawyer for Ms. Carlin's family attempted to draw a strong link between her death and Paxil, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, or SSRI, medication that the young woman had been taking for over a year when she died. Paxil put Sarah Carlin in a downward spiral starting almost as soon as she was on it, Gary Will told the inquest jury. Before she was prescribed the drug in February, he said Mrs. Carlin was a happy, athletic woman with ambitions of becoming a doctor. Over the months after she began taking Paxil, he said she told friends she was suicidal, wrote a confessional in which she said she was tired of life, and later landed in hospital after a session of drinking and cocaine use. Mr. Will also presented a Health Canada report that showed 26 people between ages 12 and 19 had committed suicide while taking an SSRI between 1993 and 2009 and cited federal government warnings that such drugs could cause suicidal thoughts for teens. But according to Paxil manufacturer GlaxoSmithKline, however, Mrs. Carlin had been depressed before she was given the drug. The teen told one doctor she had been sad and anxious since mid-2004 and sometimes experienced three panic attacks per day by February 2006, said the lawyer, Teresa Walsh. Over the months after Mrs. Carlin began taking Paxil, Mrs. Walsh said her doctors testified that she reported sleeping better and was more engaged with school. While the inquest cannot assign blame in her death, it can make recommendations to prevent similar deaths in future. Mr. Will asked the jury make several such recommendations, including doctors be forced to inform patients about the possible side effects of prescription drugs, that pharmaceutical companies be compelled to publish the results of every study into the efficacy of a drug, and that the government set up a new agency to regulate prescription drugs. For a final break in the show, we give you Omar and the Howlers one more time, Life is Just a Circle.
The world's not picture perfect, and the streets ain't paved with gold. Sometimes life can get a little bit hard, you know. You take the good times with the bad times. You take the heaven with the hell. Sometimes you just gotta draw from the wishing well. I said life is just a circle, a ride on a merry-go-round. You gotta roll with the punches. You gotta move with the ups and downs. I said life. Sometimes you feel like all the cards are stacked. And from out of nowhere, good luck will come your way. And all your troubles just vanish in the haze. I said life is just a circle, a ride on a merry-go-round. You gotta roll with the fun. A loopy loop around and round, a loopy loop around and round. Just when you think you're moving up, your life goes spinning round. I said life is just a circle.
And our story regarding a Hamilton resident and Fengate properties still goes on. I have a letter from the mental health counselor for this tenant, and I'm going to read parts of it to you. I'm a mental health counselor associated with the family practice of Dr. DiPaolo. Dr. DiPaolo referred my patient for counseling. My patient has been diagnosed with depression and anxiety disorder. I've been seeing my patient for depression and anxiety. My patient was doing fairly well and was coping with the depression and the anxiety until recently, when her living situation and her financial situation changed. My patient has been dealing for several months with her present landlord about the issue of mice. As an aside, I should say this is dated January 25th. It would seem that my patient's apartment has been infested with mice. Unfortunately, this problem has not been resolved despite my patient's complaints to management. The issues caused my patient immense distress. Her anxiety has increased, and I'm concerned about the depression. Her sleeping habits have been affected because she is seen mice on her bed. This has now induced a fear of sleeping. Her poor sleep affects her anxiety, her depression, and her ability to concentrate at work. She has boxed. Everything is now living out of boxes because of her fear for her mice being in her personal belongings. She's more irritable. She's easily angered. Is crying more often, which is affecting her relationships with family and work. I'm very concerned about her well-being. She's struggled with depression and anxiety for many years and was, before the mice situation, doing well. I'm concerned that unless something is done soon, her mental health will severely deteriorate. If you require further information, please do not hesitate to call me. Now, we have no response, as usual, from Fengate Properties. In the interim, the patient's health continues to deteriorate, and Fengate continues to deny that they're obligated to resolve the problem. As we approach the end of the month, we approach the time when federal agency community functionality facilitation will take over, or run the case through the landlord-tenant board, hopefully censure Fengate, and perhaps avoid the $50,000 a day in fees that apply, at least to the employee who denied the maintenance required under the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act, and the $150,000 a day that accrues to Fengate Properties as the public housing provider for neglecting to do the same. And from the Globe and Mail, letters to the editor, this by Robert Harrison, Scientific Director of the Hearing Foundation of Canada. Weapons of mass destruction for hearing loss. It's likely the protests at the G20 summit will fall on deaf ears. Toronto police call sonic cannons communication tools May 27th. It's also likely that if long-range acoustic devices, LRADs, are used for crowd control, protesters will end up with deaf ears too. The acoustic output even at 100 yards is well over 90 decibels, high enough to cause hearing loss. The fact is that when a sound is painful, it's also at a level that can permanently destroy hair cells of the inner ear. LRAD has been deployed against dissidents in Iraq, Georgia, China, Honduras, and pirates off the coast of Somalia. Next stop, downtown Toronto. I hope the security police at the switch will show utmost restraint in using this device because it is a weapon of mass destruction to the delicate mechanisms of our ears. Also from the Globe and Mail, Syria Grell, group files for injunction against police use of sound cannon. The Canadian Civil Liberties Association has filed an injunction against the Toronto Police and Ontario Provincial Police in an effort to disarm the controversial sound cannon before this month's G20 summit. The application for an injunction was filed with the Ontario Superior Court last Thursday, addressed to Toronto Chief William Blair and OPP Commissioner Julian Fantino. A hearing scheduled for June 23rd. Just days before international leaders, delegations, and protesters are expected to descend on Toronto for the G20 summit. At issue is the long-range acoustic device, or LRAD, four of which have been obtained by the Toronto Police in the lead-up to this summit. The beaming function should not be used because it is clearly a weapon, said Natalie DeRosier, General Counsel of the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. In our view, it should have been approved by the Solicitor General's office before it was used, and it was not, she said. A similar argument was made by the BC Civil Liberties Association before the Winter Olympics in BC this year, and Vancouver police agreed to disable the function. On Friday, Ms. DeRosier was part of a group that made submissions to the Toronto Police Services Board asking them to reconsider using the device. In addition to the potential health risks and issues of due process surrounding the LRAD, Mr. Rosier said its purchase by the police also creates a chill on freedom of assembly. Pressed on the issue last Friday, Chief Blair refused to commit to disabling the device. Constable Wendy Drummond of the Integrated Security Unit said Monday police would not comment on the matter as it is before the courts. My understanding is that it hasn't restricted our use of it until a decision is made, she said. In Pittsburgh last September, an LRAD was used against protesters during the G20 protests. It was the first time the device developed by the U.S. military had been used against civilian targets. Toronto Star, Thursday, June 10th. We saved this one for you. Former Premier Mike Harris is decrying the bully tactics of the Ontario Teachers Federation, which is threatening student teachers from Nipissing University. Harris, who's to receive an honorary doctorate of letters, that was the Friday after June the 10th, from his hometown university, was incredulous that the Federation would use the students as pawns. as a parent, a former teacher, chair of the district school board, an MPP for 20 years, and as premier, I can tell you without reservation that I always put the interests of the students first in everything I did, he told the Star by email Wednesday. In a letter to the university last month, Ontario Teachers Federation President Rino Malati warned of dire consequences if the degree were conferred on Harris, or if a new $23 million library to be shared by Nipissing and nearby Canadore College is named for the Progressive Conservative Premier who formed Ontario government from 1995 to 2002. Our members object, he said, in the strongest possible terms, given the insidious treatment of the profession by Mike Harris and his total lack of respect for its members, we cannot predict how teachers may demonstrate their displeasure should the university choose to name the new library or confer an honorary degree on Mr. Harris. Despite the ODF's gambit, both elementary and public high school teachers stopped short of jumping on the bandwagon. Said Ken Corrin, president of the Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation, are we pleased Nipissing is giving Mike Harris an honorary doctorate? Absolutely not. Are we pleased the university is naming a library for him? Absolutely not. Sam Hammond, president of the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario, said he's had outraged emails from members opposed to honoring a politician who dismantled so much of public education and attacked our profession. Nipissing University President Leslie Lovett-Dew shrugged off the OTF's veiled threat. There's been no announcement yet on naming the new library after Harris. Probably no fire insurance on it yet either. And the good news department this week. OPP accused retards of stealing. The young men had just finished cutting a client's lawn and were walking home with their equipment when an OPP car pulled up beside them. According to a statement of claim filed Monday in Brampton Small Claims Court, that's when things went wrong. Where did you steal that from? The officer Pablo Pereira asked Kyle Sheeb and his assistant, the claim says. Sheeb, who's 19, told the officer he was running a small landscaping business and that the equipment belonged to his father, Ron Sheeb. He also provided the address of the job he'd just completed and showed the officer a flyer as proof of their business. Standing beside him was his assistant, Zarek Firminov, a 20-year-old with Tourette's syndrome. He kept looking at me because he was nervous and he really didn't know what to say or do, Sheeb said. Firminov's nose was bleeding. His condition causes him to involuntarily punch himself. But according to the statement of claim, the officer implied he had been taking illicit drugs. Pereira, according to the statement of claim, checked serial numbers before confiscating the lawnmower, weed trimmer, shovel, gas can, and screwdriver. While Sheeb walked home, Pereira handcuffed Firminov, put him in the back of the marked cruiser, and drove to the client's home where they'd just been working. Officer Pereira knocked on the client's door, advised them that the plaintiff had been using stolen property while caring for their lawn, according to the lawsuit. Pereira then went to Sheeb's home, released Firminov, taunted the young man, and threw the screwdriver on the driveway, saying, "That's all you get," the lawsuit said. After returning to his vehicle, Pereira used the cruiser's loudspeaker to call a pair of retards and said he, Officer Pereira, would be using the lawnmower on his own lawn tonight, the statement says. The lawsuit seeks $25,000 in damages and names the Ontario Provincial Police and Pereira. The OPP has declined to comment on the lawsuit. Later that evening, the lawsuit says Pereira and several other officers returned to the Sheeb residence and returned the property without asking for any proof of ownership. When Sheeb went to the detachment a few days later to file a complaint, he was told Pereira had not filed a report. The lawsuit says the OPP failed to respond appropriately to inquiries from the legitimate owner of the property. That's it for Disrespect. Come back next week. We can assure you, as always, there will be more. Going out, Omar and the Howlers, Radio Man.
From my mouth, I sell cures to the air, blast the blues to move your soul. It's the music makes me manic, it's the power makes me roll. I'm the radio man, have mercy. I'm the radio man, I'm the man with the plan. I'm
having so much fun. My broadcast from the border reach across the land. The stake on that religious, send your money to the man. Search it down from the Rio and my words will come alive. Cause I got the gift of gab, I was born to chow and jive. My rap, I'm having so much fun.
If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.